Hi, good afternoon. My name is Billy Noonan. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, through Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of action I probably didn't want to take, I've been sober since January the 5th of 1990. I got to say some things straight from the start, because sometimes there's a lot of confusion about this piece of wood that I'm behind. The first confusion is that I'm not on it, on top of it. I don't speak for AA. I'm not some AA angel poster child. It's a podium, and there's a human being behind it. And I have to be honest, you know, there's some days I can be a good little AA and be the front of the room with my book open. And there's some days I can be in the back with a cup of coffee next to my best buddy judging the hell out of everyone else there. I mean, you know, that's just me. And I'm not some nice guy that started drinking and got into trouble. That's not my story. If it's someone else's, that's okay. At about age 12, I learned about the seedier, so-called bad, dark side of life. Since 12, I was attracted to the seedier, dark, bad side of life. Before I ever picked up a drink, that side of life has always looked more fun to me. When I was 12 years old, I did not think about being in the Honor Society, going to West Point. That looked boring. That looked not fun. So I know one thing, you know, that I love Chris's humor. I know I've spoken in Texas before, so I know I won't say it's good to be in the South, because the last time I said that, some guy waited all the way online after the meeting, and when he got up to me, he said, "Billy, I'm sure you don't know this, but the South is east of Texas." So I know that now, you know? I know the South is east of Texas, you know? And one of the things that I appreciate about Texas is that I live in New Jersey, but I am a New Yorker. I was born there, raised there. I assure you, screwing a New Jersey license plate on my car took a lot of, like, prayer and meditation. Because I'm an arrogant, stubborn New Yorker who believes that why would anyone live anywhere else, you know, but in New York. I really appreciated the speaker this morning, and I'm going to do what the book tells me to do, which is to share in a general way my experience, strength, and hope on what it used to be like, how I got here, and how it is today. And what I can't do here today is I can't take you through the book and give you a spiritual experience. What I can urge you with, if there's anything else that I could say today, is that if you have not done that, when you leave here, find someone. Find someone who's gone through the book with someone else who's gone through the book. Don't work the book or try to work the steps in a meeting. You're going to have to take the time, because these miracles get worked over kitchen tables and in diners and one-on-one. You know, so that's the really only, you know, I have to say that. If I can give someone some hope of how you can be a pathetic, malcontent, antisocial, violent tendencies, the whole list is long, and how you can kind of get your life back together a day at a time, depending on your spiritual condition, that I can do. That I can tell you about with my bad examples. I'm not here today to be the poster child. I have some really bad examples of my conduct in sobriety and the bad consequences that have come as a result of them, and how I've had to get my head out of my you-know-what and tell someone honestly where I am and go through the process again. I mean, I'll say a couple of things this morning. I wrote down two things when he was talking. The first thing he said is, I came to AA when I was 15. You're not a good kid if you wind up in AA at 15, you know? It's just a rule of thumb, you know? Even if you're not an alcoholic, if you wind up in AA at age 15, life's going a different direction than your parents planned on. And but the speaker this morning said, there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. Now, I say yes, unless you're a chronic teenage alcoholic. If you're a chronic teenage alcoholic, and I think I saw a few here, There is one thing worse. That's a belly full of booze and a mom's head full of black belt Al-Anon. That is a horrible combination. A horrible combination. If you drink like I drink, and you like to behave the way I like to behave, and you like to not follow rules and hang out with bad people, Al-Anon is evil. It interferes with my right to have a good time. It interferes with my right to drink the only thing that's ever made me feel whole. And Al-Anon, and if, I know there's probably members of Al-Anon here today, and I got to tell you that I really love Al-Anon. And I got to tell you that my history as an alcoholic is that I'm too nice to alcoholics. I tend to be too compassionate to alcoholics. I tend to not want to let them fall. You know, I love the footsteps prayer, but I love the Al-Anon version more, if you've ever heard it. And that's the one where the guy looks back at his life and he says, "Hey, God, I thought you were with me here. How come there's only, you know, one set of prints there?" And, you know, God answers back like the prayer says, "Well, that's where I was carrying you." And he says, "Well, what's with 5 feet later where there's a big, like, hole in the sand?" He says, "Well, that's where I dropped you on your ass." You know? You know? And what I've learned in AA is that this is a family disease. And I will talk about the family disease. I will not talk about the family disease that it made me an alcoholic. So let's make that clear. I suffer from the condition that's described in the doctor's opinion of the big book. I have the physical compulsion. I've never not had a second drink. I have a lot of great war stories, but they all have one thing in common. I was never able to not have the second drink. But I come from a family wrecked with alcoholism. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Now, the other thing the speaker said is we all have things in AA that bother us the most when we hear them. Right at the top of my list now is I put myself on the top of my amends list. That's my personal favorite right now, of how a guy like me, who has destroyed lives, gone through like a tornado, lied from you, stolen from you, cheated on you, the whole list, how a guy like me could put myself at top of the list. I mean, that's what I love to do, is put myself on top of the list. So I'm going to say I'm sorry to Billy before the 1,000 other people whose lives I've wrecked in the last 24 years. I mean, I hear that and I just say, God, where does that stuff come from? Because it's not in the book that I read. And, you know, I said, I grew up Irish Catholic. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. You know, it might make me a little bit more thirsty and a little bit more guilty, but it doesn't make you an alcoholic, you know? It just doesn't. It doesn't. And I come from a house with 42 first cousins, you know, and that's not a lot where I come from. You know, in my family, the birth control is if you are pregnant, you can't get pregnant, you know, so that's just the rule of thumb. And I'll explain how that big extended family, I love today, but there's one thing we don't believe in or admit exists, and that's alcoholism. There's a lot of rules I was raised with, and they are not the 24 set of spiritual principles on the wall over there, I assure you. In fact, they're almost completely opposite. And I just need to say something before I go on with my story, and that is, I will say something today that will be offensive, and that's because I led an offensive life. At my very nature, I'm offensive to be around. I'm offensive to bring home to your friends' families. I'm offensive to go out with. I'm offensive in public. And I'm not a nice person. That's just, it sounds funny, but if you looked at my inventories, you would know that it's true. So when I say a couple of things today, if they sound kind of harsh, just wait until I finish, because I probably said them for a reason. I have a great life today. And that's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and God and the work through the steps. I just want to say this. You know, it's nice to go around and speak at conventions. It's nice to meet a lot of people. But as I was telling a couple of people today, last Friday night I went upstate New York to speak at a convention. And somebody said to me that night, "You don't look overly excited to be here." And I had to really be honest with him. And, you know, through my inventories, I've found that I am a people pleaser at the very nature. Some of my biggest forms of dishonesty is being people pleasing. And so I'll say whatever it is to fit in or be popular. And I had to tell this person last Friday night, I'm honored to be at your convention. I'm honored to show up for Alcoholics Anonymous. However, 3 hours ago, all my sober buddies went out to dinner. Right now, they're all in the meeting I usually go to. An hour from now, they'll all be smoking cigars and playing the Texas Hold'em game we play every Friday night. But that's my regular AA life, my lifeline to being able to be a member of this program. And the day that speaking at conventions and getting on a plane to speak at a podium in front of a big crowd is more important than just being one of the guys in AA, I need to get my ass off a plane. I mean, that's just the bottom line. That's the truth. When someone says, am I a circuit speaker? Well, I say, well, that depends on if your definition of a circuit speaker is someone who's willing to fly halfway around the world but not willing to walk 10 feet across a room to say hello to a newcomer. If that's your definition of a circuit speaker, then I am not. You know, I told you I grew up in this family, and I come from a house destroyed by alcoholism. My dad was a deep cover, undercover narcotics officer in the 70s, buying a lot of heroin, working inside organized crime, not home for days, weeks at a time in foreign countries. My mom was an untreated Al-Anon, and we had one big happy family. And, you know, let me tell you about some of the things that I need to tell you, because the work that I've done in the book, I'd love to tell you that I had to spend a lot of time on learning new things, but I'm unfortunate I need to report to you that I've had to spend a lot of time unlearning what I learned. Unlearning what was taught was normal and true. You see, I was raised to be a racist. I was raised to be anti-Semitic. I was raised to be sexist. I was raised to be homophobic. I was raised to basically hate everyone that's not an Irish Catholic, New York cop, fireman, electrician, pipe fitter, something like that. If you fit in that little box, we like you. If you don't fit in that little box, just stay out of our life. So that's the truth. If I were to say here anything different, it would not be true. Now, in that household, I learned a lot of things. You see, I learned a number one rule in life when you come from a family like mine, and that is what happens in the house stays in the house. If you don't live there, you're not privy to the secrets of the house anymore. That does not make me an alcoholic. It doesn't. It has nothing to do with my membership here of suffering from the disease as stated in the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism. However, my character defects grew by the hundreds in what I was taught and learned. They don't make me an alcoholic, but I'll tell you this. My alcoholism, me picking up a drink, plus those character defects equal a raging tornado. That's what the math equals. You can't. To put those kind of learned behaviors together with my alcoholism was a disaster. And you see, so I lived in this house, and let me just give you a glimpse of the Noonan household. Dad's been away all week. God knows where. He comes home in a different car every day. He comes home in a Corvette some days. He comes home in a power company truck. He comes home in a New York telephone truck. That was his life, and he was very good at it. And like I found me to be, he was hated by those he lived with and was closest to, and loved and like the guy's guy outside the house. That's who he was. That's who I became. Now, on that Friday night or Saturday, whenever he chose to come home, let me just describe something for you. See, on January 5th of 1990, the guy you're looking at didn't show up to AA. Let me tell you who showed up to AA. A 23-year-old boy who never lost a fight, never cried a tear, and was afraid of nothing. 14 years later, I'll tell you who showed up to AA. A guy that got his ass kicked more often than not. A guy who cried but never in front of other people. And basically lived his whole life in fear and afraid of everybody and everything. But that's not who showed up on January 5th, 1990. On January 5th, 1990, I was convinced you people were going to have to write a new book with a new chapter called The Worst Case to Ever Come to AA, you know, because that's how grandiose I was, you know, the toughest guy ever to get sober, some ridiculous nonsense like that. See, on a Friday night in my house, if I would go to bed, I would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning because I would usually hear a wedding picture being shattered or somebody falling down because they were thrown. And you see, I would be crying in the corner of my bedroom, praying that my dad's weapon would not go off, that he would not take his own life, that he would not kill my mom, that my mom would not kill him. See, but it's miraculous if you live in a household that's filled with the family disease of alcoholism. See, because 6 hours later, at 10 o'clock in the morning, I would get up to go upstairs. My mom would be whistling, making pancakes. I would think like I dreamed what went on because it didn't go on. That's the party line. What happened at 4 o'clock in the morning last night did not go on. My dad would be sitting in his favorite chair listening to the Emerald Society Bagpipe Band album Drinking Johnny Walker Already. And we would get into the state. See, when you have 42 Irish Catholic first cousins, it makes the springtime a very interesting time of year. See, the springtime with 42 first cousins is a revolving door of baptisms, first communions, confirmations, graduations. Every weekend you go to a different one. And when you show up there, you might be the Channel 7 after school special family when you get in the station wagon. But wherever you get to, whether it's 2 miles or 20, you better be the Brady Bunch when you get out, or there'll be a price to pay. That's just the truth. I made the mistake one day of telling a kid on the neighborhood what happened the night before in my house on the bus stop. He went home and told his mother. His mother ran into my mother in the supermarket and asked if she was okay, that she had heard. My mom told my dad, and then he beat the living hell out of me. I never did that again. Him beating me up does not make me an alcoholic. You know, I just want to tell you, my favorite line in the big book these days, it was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. It's my favorite line. Because how I was raised, how my day's going, how hard my life is, has nothing to do with the fact that I suffer from the illness described in the big book. However, my inventories, and I use the plural on purpose, meaning that many of them have, unfortunately, that last column, I can't say I was drinking. That's a hard pill to swallow sometimes when you're 14 years sober and doing an inventory and the same pattern is on there that's been there. And it's not really what you did, but why you did it. I mean, I like to call that column sounded like a good time idea at the time. You know, that's the story and history of my life sounded like a good idea at the time. Except the spiritual consequences, whether I am drinking or not, grow if I keep acting like that. And in my household, I learned a lot of rules, and they're not all good ones. But I learned that when we got to that party, men go here and women go here. And that my poster-child alcoholic Uncle Frank always brought the poker chips, $200 worth of singles and quarters, and the bookie's phone number if it was New Year's Day or Thanksgiving so we could make last-minute calls into the football bookie. I mean, that's how I grew up. See, by the time I was 12 years old, I talked about the seedier side of life. By the time I was 12 years old, I knew an upside-down shot glass knew my dad had a drink coming. I knew my dad kept his money on the bar and the bartender made it change. I remember when I went to a bar for the first time as a teenager and my friends bought beers and put their change in their pocket. But I knew to keep my money on the bar, that the bartender would make change for me. You know, I mean, my parents did not write books that you find in Barnes & Noble on how to raise a healthy family, you know. I love them to death, but you're not going to find their book published there. I knew how to play 8-ball, 9-ball, all the rules of darts. I knew what points on a game meant. I knew how to fill out the little weekly football card. I knew all that stuff. And first drink. You know, I can only tell you what first drink in my family means for this alcoholic. Splitting a beer with my dad at Yankee Stadium is not my first drink, as per my family's definition. Going on a fishing trip with my dad and having a beer, that's not my first drink. You know, my first drink, I can identify with no problem. You see, my mom kicked my dad out of the house by the time I was 13, and I hated her for it. And I hated her for a long time. A long time. I always side with the active alcoholic. If there's two people involved in a dispute, I always side with the tragic, drastic tornado. You know, I have a little sympathy for that person. The normal, so be regular person, they just like to kill a little fun, in my opinion. So my mom kicked my dad out, so I hated her. You know, I started to get into trouble in school. You know, I hear people say, well, you're mentally and physically different. Listen, my book is clear. I am not mentally and physically different from my fellows prior to January 5th of 1990. The person who is talking to you today, me, is mentally and physically different from my fellows. I am. Physically, I suffer from this disease called alcoholism. I cannot safely take the first drink. Even when I wake up completely sober the next day, my brain sometimes tells me to take the first drink. I suffer from that disease. Mentally, it's not even a good topic from the podium as far as today. I'll give you a quick example. I travel a lot for work. I was away with two people recently. We all got a rental car. I usually travel alone. We got to this rental car place at 10:30 at night. They had one car, a very fast car. Now, the guy who was driving, we got out of the lot. I knew where we were going, so did they. There were two choices, highway, local. But my brain immediately says, hey, aren't you going to take this thing on the highway and see what it can do? I mean, that's what I said out loud, you know? Like, why would we have a car like this and not see what it can do? You know? I'm telling you, this is a couple months ago. You know what he said? It's fascinating, the brain of a normal person. He turned around in the car and said, you know, I don't want to get a speeding ticket. Now, that's a nice answer, but if you're a guy like me, let's just play out that story. Let's say I was driving. Let's just say I got pulled over for speeding. If you're a guy like me, having a valid license, registration, and insurance card is like winning Powerball. Having three of those things with my name on it that are all valid right now, you know, and I wish it sounds funny, but it's the pathetic truth. You know, Chris asked me how old I was. Let me tell you. A couple of years ago, I lived in Chicago for work during sobriety. On my 34th birthday, you know, your driver's license expires on your birthday. Of course, being an alcoholic, it was the day before my birthday I went to motor vehicle. But let me tell you the revelation that went through my mind. I was a 34-year-old man, supposedly. And that was the first time in my life I ever renewed a driver's license. How do people do that? How do they keep one for 4 years without it getting suspended or revoked? Or, you know, like, I had never made it that whole four-year period in my lifetime. And you think, like, that is pathetic. That's crazy, but that's the truth. I never made it until I stayed sober because I lost mine for a good period of time for a while, and I'll get into that. So, you know, that's the kind of thinking and family I come from. And, you know, so I hated my mom. My dad was my hero, and he was a raging alcoholic. And one night, I went, you see, I tried sports. I tried Boy Scouts. I tried everything to not be home, to be out of myself. I couldn't even tell other people that my dad didn't live home anymore. I was so devastated by him not living there. But you see, at 16 years old, I pulled into a 7-Eleven parking lot with like five other guys in the back of a Nova or a Monte Carlo or Dusta, whatever the car the early 80s, late 70s was, listening to Sabbath, having a good time, and somebody bought me my first 8-pack of Miller's, those small bottles. That night, the ease and comfort that it talks about in the doctor's opinion occurred for me for the first time in my life. For the first time in my life, I felt equal to everyone else. For the first time in my life, That hole in my stomach was gone. Now, that sounds hokey to other people, but to somebody like me, I had been searching for that. So I got to tell you, it took me like 15 years to find that. I wasn't ready to get rid of it easy. You know, and I discovered a couple of things. If you're new, I tell this all the time. You know, the step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. The big book says you need to concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. And I tell people all the time, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I'm not doing the other 11. I mean, that's just me. I'm not a nice kind of let's be merry, believe in God kind of guy naturally, you know? It's that first step gives me no choice but your way out. And, you know, as my good friend Tom I says, the level of your surrender in step one will be equally proportionate to the level of your results in steps 2 to 11. And I believe that wholeheartedly. You have to know what your problem is before the solution will work. And so, if you're new and you don't know if you're an alcoholic, I suggest you sit down with someone. Because, see, I know today things that make me different. See, at 16 years old, I was the lunatic who shaved his football number in one side of his head and the name of my team in the other. And I thought I was a good guy to bring out if you were going to get into a fight with another town. You know, my high school yearbook had that section that says, I predict in 20 years. I never, you know, if you're the chronic teenage alcoholic like I am, let me talk about the progression it talks about in the big book. When I was a ninth grader and I went to school on Monday morning, the only thing that consumed my mind was what's going on Friday night. When I was a 10th grader and I went to school on Monday mornings, really the only thing that went through my mind is, what are we doing Thursday or Friday night? By the time I was a junior in high school, the only thing that went through my mind is, I can't possibly wait till Thursday or Friday night. That's the progression of my illness. By the time I was a senior, I rarely was in school on a Monday morning to begin with to even worry about that. But that's how my progression went. When I look back at my drinking, especially with the aid of an alcoholic who's been through the work, I know what made me mentally and physically different from my fellows. You ever play? I don't know when I'm in different parts of the country, but drinking games always killed me. Up north, we play a game called quarters, where someone bounces a nice little quarter off a table, and it goes in a shot glass. I mean, how painful is it to wait for some moron to get a quarter in a shot glass to point at me so I can drink, you know? And I'm supposed to believe that I'm being punished because you're telling me to drink. I mean, I never really got that concept. I still today don't understand the whole drinking game thing if you're an alcoholic like myself. You see, I'm the guy who, when I go to your mother's refrigerator at 11:30 at night, I take 2 beers, not one. I put one in her Tupperware drawer or in her tinfoil drawer, wherever, because, see, when you're 17 years old and you're like me, you can be in a blackout listening to Sabbath, but that air going dry in a keg, I could hear that 50 feet away. You know what I mean? And at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you're a real alcoholic like I am, I cannot be 17 years old and have it be 2 o'clock in the morning and not have my own supply of alcohol. That does not equal out for a guy like me. It's not a good idea. So, you know, I'm the kind of guy that, you know, other hard drinker teenagers, you know, let's just, you know, you're listening to Ozzy, you're going to a party, somebody's parents are away, there's going to be 5 kegs there, the 4 of the guys are happy. You see, I have to manipulate some way to go to 7-Eleven. Because if I want the ease and comfort, see, I want to be able to go get a backup 6-pack. I like walking into your parents' backyard and putting my 6-pack in your bushes where no one else knows it is. See, because I like having that keg hose in my hand, and I like having the ease and comfort that when this runs out, I'm okay. That's the ease and comfort that I'm talking about when I'm drinking. Otherwise, my mind is obsessed with this is going to run out. And I can't have that happen until I black out and pass out. You know, I always say, as a 17-year-old alcoholic, the two worst sounds in the world are a dry keg and a siren. Other than those two sounds, I'm okay. But either one of those sounds has ruined a lot of good nights drinking of mine. So I know I was different. You know, back in the 80s, I date myself, metal detectors really weren't in yet. And I had this great 3/4-length army jacket. It had all these inside pockets where you could fit like a six-pack. It had the WHO Quadrophenia symbol painted on the back, you know, and that was my winter attire. In the summer, I switched to my Levi Ozzy oil painting on the back of my dungaree jacket. But in the winter, I stuck with my green army jacket. And, you know, before metal detectors at concerts, they invented these things called pat-down lines, where you would go through like this gauntlet of guys who would take you down. See, if you're a heavy drinker and you're 17 years old, and you're going to Van Halen or you're going to Monsters of Rock, see, it's more important for you to hear the music. To you, the music is top priority. If you're an alcoholic of my type, as described in the Big Book, I love heavy metal. But I can't be inside there and depend upon someone else to keep my disease running. So I'm willing to risk the pat-down line. You know, I'm willing to not make it in. And what I've found out, and it still confuses me today, is when you get kicked out of a concert, that's a pretty fun crowd to hang out with in the parking lot. You ever hang out with them? The 300 or 400 other people who haven't been allowed in? I mean, that is a good crowd of people. That is a good time. You know, I've had a lot of great nights in the parking lot of Giant Stadium and Brendan Byrne Arena because I'm not a nice guy. You know, I tell you that. Let me give you an example of my alcoholism, where it takes me. I remember Def Leppard, their drummer, had a tragic accident. He lost an arm in a car accident. I was a teenager. I was hammered going to that concert because once I start drinking, I cannot stop. Inside that concert, there was some guy sitting in front of me who was like had his own drumsticks with him and was playing the drums, and I was making fun of. He thought I was impressed. In fact, at one point, he turned around and gave me a set of drumsticks like I wanted to play along with him. Like, anyway, I had a long sleeve shirt on at the time, and I took my left arm and I put it inside my shirt to kind of make fun of the drummer who lost his arm, and I knew this guy in front of me was such a big fan. Now, that's a horrible thing to do. There's nothing kind or loving about that. There's nothing kind or loving about getting in a fight with your arm inside your shirt either, let me tell you that. But let me tell you, after he kicked my ass, then Brendan Byrne Arena security kicked my ass, and then I went out to the parking lot and got a beer, and I was okay. You see, I suffer from a problem, and maybe some other people can identify. See, when I drink and I black out, by 3 o'clock in the morning, I pretty much lose control of just about every muscle in my body, except for my mouth. My mouth has the exact opposite. It's amazing. My mouth works better, more often, louder. So, you know, I told you, that high school yearbook, I predict in 20 years, that nice hokey section that I was too cool to fill out. Well, if you got my high school yearbook, I could show it to you. There are two about me. One says St. John's Hospital will dedicate a wing to Billy N. And the other says Billy N will have broken every bone and torn every muscle and ligament in his body. Now, at the time when I was 18 or 17 years old and read that, I thought that meant I was a cool guy. I thought that meant I was the life of the party. I stand here today. I have no left kidney. I have no spleen. My ribs have been kicked in because that mouth doesn't stop working when I'm laying on the concrete floor behind Patrick's Pub and someone is kicking me and I have to get the last word in. Stitches, broken bones, the whole list. It's horrible. It's horrible that two people had that great an insight into my life and that my disease had absolutely no idea. You know, and I'll end my drinking story by telling you this. I know why I drank. Just read the book. I don't need to do an hour stand up on it. But I can tell you this. See, no matter how bad the consequences ever were, when I woke up the next day and stumbled into a 7-Eleven and maybe got a big gulp for my sore throat and a new pack of cigarettes and a Nestle's Crunch Bar, I mean, because I needed nicotine, caffeine, and sugar. I lived on nicotine, caffeine, and sugar when I first woke up, which was usually at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. See, when I look back at the night before, my problem is that I can always identify 15 minutes or a half an hour where drinking did for me what I wanted it to do. I look back at the night before, and there could be 14 hours of carnage on either side of that 15 minutes. But inside that 15 minutes, I'm who I wanted to be. Every guy I thought was afraid of me or wanted to be like me, every woman wanted to be with me, that 15 minutes, the figment of my imagination that it was, no matter how bad the consequences were, I couldn't live sober in my own skin. I was not comfortable in my own skin. And, you know, I'd love to tell you that that part of my life went away, but I want to tell you a quick little sobriety story. I'd wish I could say it's 13 years old. I'd love to say it's 13 years old. It's not. It's 4 years old, 5 years old, around 4 or 5. I had 2 knee surgeries in sobriety. I went to the knee doctor for like my final visit, and he said, "Bill, you should quit playing softball." I said, "You're right." Just like I used to tell the probation officer, the social worker, the guidance counselor, "You're right, I should quit drinking. You're right, I should quit softball. I shouldn't play anymore." And what he was really saying was, "Bill, you should grow up. You do not have the knees of an 18-year-old anymore." Well, anyway, I showed up. I was so proud of myself. All these meetings I went into in Chicago. "You playing softball this year?" "Nope, not me. I'm done." "You joining the softball league?" "Nope, I'm done." "You playing co-ed?" "Nope, I'm done with softball." So I'm walking to this AA picnic, and I'm walking down Lakeshore Drive like 6 months later. And I see what I can make out to be a pickup game. Like there's an empty box of hamburgers for third base all squished. There's somebody's shirt for second base. There's something else for first base. And you know what the first thought that went through my mind was? He was talking about league. He wasn't talking about a friendly game among members of AA. Well, let me tell you, I've been sober for 14 years. I have yet to meet a friendly game among recovering people anywhere of anything. I don't care if it's spades, euchre, Monopoly, Trivial Pursuit. I have yet to meet one of us that doesn't like to win. I'm looking for that person. But I seem to be involved in a lot of games of a lot of us where we like to compete and we like to win. So I'm walking to that baseball field, and, you know, it's amazing when you do enough inventories. It's amazing and horrible, depending on which way you look at it, and how your life is going. Because, so there I am in left field, and there's a guy up at bat, and it's the third inning. And what do I say to myself? Well, number one, I don't like this guy. I've never met him, but I don't like him. Now, what do my inventories tell me about that? Well, he's good looking, and my ego is given even the stretch that he could possibly be almost as good at me as softball. Like, that's the kind of chronic ego that you could have, that I have in my head. So I don't like him at all. So he's up and he rips a wicked line drive. Now, if you've played ball as long as I have, you would know that you were going to catch this on one hop and throw it to the second baseman, and he would be stuck at first. Now, this is not an exaggeration. This is the truth. That night, about 5 hours later, as I was limping severely to my car with dried blood all over my knee and my sock and my shorts, and my knee was like this big, and the empty Ziploc bag that the hamburgers were in, I now had to empty and stuff with ice and duct tape around my knee. And as I was walking in severe pain, the only thought that went through this sick mind was, that may have been the greatest catch I have ever made. You know? Really. It's the only thought that went through it. And I said to myself, and it's worth all this pain, you know? No different than my drinking. You know, it doesn't matter how I woke up. It doesn't matter what happened the night before. Consequences will never stop me from picking up. And, you know, I love the first time I met Chris and heard him speak. I'm not afraid to talk about the good things that happened to me in recovery. I'm not afraid of going back to jail. I'm not afraid of eating room service room food off of a room service cart that someone already ate. That stuff is survival. We are survivalists. I often say if I had my own country and I had a special forces, it would be made up of alcoholics. Because you can't kill us, you know? It's amazing, you know? It's amazing. Amazing. You know, and some of us die from this disease. And my heart goes out to the people who die from this disease. But it is amazing, those of us who should have died many, many times. And God, do we just keep coming back for more pain and more pain. And you know, I came to AA when I was 15 years old. AA is not like the attractive place when you're 15. I remember being 15 years old, sitting in a church basement, somebody flicking out the lights. This, like, old person at the time was 40-something, came out with a sheet cake on their arms, with candles, and all these adults started singing Happy Birthday, and I was like, this is exactly what I thought AA was and exactly why I want no part of it, you know? Like, I had no idea. You know, and I heard a guy say one time in AA, he didn't get hangovers anymore. So I was like, whoa, this is why I'm here today. I need to learn this, whatever he's going to say, because I break ice cube trays on my mother's kitchen table on beach towels and roll them up and put them on my head. I'm so hungover. And he said, he doesn't get hangovers anymore because he doesn't drink a day at a time. Oof. That seemed a little drastic for a case like me. No? About a month later, I met this really hot bartender, and she told me that I didn't prepare to drink good enough, that I didn't coat my stomach, I didn't put a big glass of ice water on my nightstand, I didn't put two extra strength Tylenols. That seemed more workable for a guy like me. Except, I loved what he said this morning about insanity. I love that, knowing what's going to happen and doing it anyway. Because how many nights did I go out doing that? And the next morning, the water's spilt. I don't even know if I took the aspirin. There's two empty tall boys of Budweiser that I'd stopped at a 7-Eleven for travelers on the way home. There's empty White Castle boxes. I mean, that, you know, but I'm going to try that again. I'm going to see if it works. Because, you know, I just... And what I learned in AA, AA is an amazing place. You see, if you're a young alcoholic like I was, you start to learn that your life is not going down the yellow brick road. And so the first time I got sent to outpatient treatment, I noticed the guys who threw out the slang, the AA slang, they seemed to get a little bit of leeway. I seemed to always get picked on. Like they would say, oh yeah, I went to a big book meeting, I went to a beginner's meeting, I went to the meeting after the meeting, I'm working the steps out of the book with my sponsor. So I started to learn, well, I at least need to start saying that stuff, you know? I need to start doing that stuff. You see, let me tell you about AA and recovery for a guy like me and why I hated AA. Because why I hated AA has a good part to do with why I love it so much today. See, my whole life, I had been told by guidance counselors, social workers, teachers who deal with the violent students, oh, poor Billy. His parents went through a horrible divorce. His dad's a deep cover narcotics cop. He was raised in a horrible house. Poor Billy. See, AA, when I was listening, you started talking about, I remember a guy in AA, I'll never forget when he said this. He said, here's the difference between AA and everything else. Everything else tells you to be hard on others and easy on yourself. Here, we tell you to be hard on yourself and easy on others. I didn't like hearing that. Here, they were talking about this last column. I didn't even know what they were talking about. But they were talking about their part of it, their role in it. What part did they play? That was the last thing I wanted to hear. I played no part. I'm a victim of a bad family and tragic social circumstances. That was my view, and I was sticking with it. I got arrested for the first time when I was 17. My dad's job got me out of a lot of trouble. I would always show up to court, be dressed up, have a list of AA meetings I went to, get my slap on the wrist, have the charges dismissed, that whole bit, you know. By the time I was 23 years old, I had a good job. I drank every day. I worked with people, and the people I hung out with at work drank every day. I now had a job where I had an ID card like my dad did that got me out of jail free. And I thought my life was going the path it was supposed to go. Okay? I do not know how to go fishing without drinking. I did not know how to go to a Yankee game without drinking. My whole life was drinking. And, you know, in December of 1989, I went to a Christmas party, and that night I killed someone drinking and driving, and that does not make me an alcoholic. See, I love the part in the Big Book where it says, "We're men and women that lost the ability to control our drinking, period." And in the last week, sometimes it just comes in spurts, I've been contacted by two people who also killed people drinking and driving and are new in AA. And I can just tell you my experience, and I got to quantify this. If there's anyone here today who's lost a friend, a loved one, a family member to a drunk driver, I don't expect you to like me nor respect me. It is my job to like or respect you. That's the truth. I'm not here for sympathy, and I'm not here for a pat on the back because I don't deserve one. The hardest thing it is for me was to learn that the day before my accident, I suffered from the disease of alcoholism as described in the Big Book. The accident was just a result of me taking my will back again. Not a result of God's will, me. Me taking my will back. God wants me to be a sober, sane, decent member of society. And, you know, that car accident obviously changed my life very much. And I still hated AA. I got sober on January 5th of 90. I still, you know, my mom, God rest her soul, I got involved in a group, and they were a Big Book group. I still hated AA, but I knew this was my only shot. I got sentenced. My mom drove me to court to drop me off that day. She could not even go inside and watch me because I wasn't going in the door to the right where you go out and get processed and bail. I was going in the door to the left where you get on the big bus with the star on it, chained to about 20 other guys. And my mom couldn't even go in and see that. And what I told her that morning was, you know, Mom, you and Dad should be going to jail. You should have never gotten married. You should have never had kids. And now your oldest son is going to jail as a result of how horrible our life was. And that's my frame of mind at that time. That's just my honest story. The correctional facility I was in had AA meetings, thank God. It had a Big Book meeting. And what I have one soapbox in AA, and I'm going to get on it and off it very quick. If you've been told that because you've never been to jail, you have nothing to share with inmates who are in recovery inside, you've been lied to by someone who's never been an inmate in recovery. Because it has nothing to do except one alcoholic working with another. Circumstances change, are different. But for the most part, people like me can't even go back in jail for a little while. We depend upon people who've never been arrested to go in because of the clearance procedures. You know, I did my first fourth step inside a correctional facility. And it probably wasn't the best or most perfect. But I can only steal a line from my good friend Tom I, who says, his wasn't the best or most perfect either, but to this day in his life, it's the most important day's work he's ever done. That's true for me. See, I had never sat down and taken a look at my actions. I had never sat down and taken an honest inventory of me. And, you know, inside that correctional facility, it's funny because, you know, I hear so many stories about jails and prisons, but I can tell you that my AA group, the first night I went, I got pulled aside, and this isn't in any AA pamphlet, but I'll tell you what I was told. Do not use this meeting as a way to bring contraband across the facility. If you do that, we will lose our meeting, and we can't afford that. Well, that was clear enough direction for me, because the rules inside there. And, you know, I listened to a tape, I got to honestly tell you, and I listened to a tape of a speaker who said, sobriety time in jail doesn't count. And that tape pissed me off, to be quite honest, because I could get high or drunk anytime I wanted where I was. And, you know, when you're trying to work these 12 spiritual principles and you live in the jungle, it is not a good combination. It doesn't fit like a glove. They are completely contradictory. And I right away decided I hate all circuit speakers. This guy's an idiot. I can't wait to meet him someday. I'm going to kick his ass. The whole bit, you know? Well, anyway, about October of 1990, I walked into the library of the facility I was in where we had our meeting, and we had a box of speaker tapes. And for whatever reason, and I thank God for this, I walked over to that speaker tape box, and the top box said, Tom I, Aberdeen, North Carolina. And I pulled that tape out, and I put it in my Walkman, and I sat on my cot. And I heard a story of a man who, when he was 23 years old, killed two people drinking and driving. He was now like 30 years sober. He had went to prison for his crime, and now he was a warden of a correctional facility. You know, if you have not heard your story in AA, if you have not gotten the hope that you're looking for, all I can urge you is don't judge the messenger. Don't be like me. Go there looking for the message. If you're like me and you see a black guy get up, well, he doesn't know what it's like to be me. If you see a gay guy get up, if you see a woman get up, all that ridiculous nonsense that has nothing to do except for that somebody suffers from the same disease as I do. And, you know, that tape gave me the hope. And, you know, my recovery the last 14 years, you know, I always say this isn't, you know, it's not been a yellow brick road to sobriety, you know, but my life is the best it's ever been. That's just the truth. You know, the big book, sometimes I hate when we read the promises in meetings because people hear them. They have no idea where they are. You know, in North Carolina, they have these meetings. They're called FTL meetings. That stands for blank the lamination. I won't say the first word because they want newcomers to read the traditions or how it works and see where it is in the book, not on a sheet of paper. And, you know, there's a lot of promises in the big book way before those promises. But one of them that I take to heart still today is, and I'm not a good paraphraser, there are a lot of better big book thumpers than I am, but I'll tell you the one I love, the certain low spots ahead. It's not like maybe you'll have low spots. It's not like you'll be on a yellow brick road for the rest of your life. It's like the certain low spots. And I'll tell you, I'm going to be honest. When my life is in a jam, when something bad is going on in my life, it's easy for me to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is second nature. When my life is great, when I have no problems, when things are going fine, that's when I have to be militant about it's the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. It doesn't matter. Good times, bad times has nothing to do with my AA membership and doing the work in the book. And so, you know, in the Bronx, they say a lot, you can be in AA or you can be in around AA. If you want to be around AA, hey, good luck. If you want to stay sober, get in the middle of AA. You know, when they say very clearly, join a group, get a sponsor, get active. Get up in the morning and thank God and ask Him for a sober day, even if you don't believe in Him. Read 2 pages out of the big book, call another alcoholic, go to a meeting that night, and at night get on your knees and thank God, even if you don't believe in him. If you can do those five things, that's a good foundation right now. You know, no one told me don't get in the steps right away. No one told me take it easy, you know? I mean, there are certain things about AA I love. Certain things I love, that the worse you are, the more you like me. That I really like. There's nowhere else on earth where the worse kind of person you are, the more we love you in AA. The more we can't wait to meet you, you know? You know, but there's a flip side of that. Because let me talk about my mother for a little bit. See, in AA, supposedly you're doing 90 and 90, you got a sponsor, a home group, a commitment. Everyone loves you. See, but a 90 and 90 doesn't get rid of 23 years of being a tornado in somebody's life. A 90 and 90 does not get rid of the wreckage of the past. And what I've learned, unfortunately, is that the people I harm the most are the people closest to me. Some of the hardest amends I've ever had to make. I've made amends to the mother of the boy that I killed drinking and driving. The father remains on my A-step list because he wishes not to have any contact with me. That's just for me to deal with and live with. Amends to my parents, my siblings, and everyone else have been difficult. My first 2 years outside of jail, my mom would not let me home because she thought I was a disruptive influence to her other three children who she was trying to find a loving place for. And I would go to the 79th Street workshop in New York and serve food to the homeless and to other people in AA. And, you know, if you're new, let me just bring you into my head, 25 years old, walking down Broadway in New York City, hating God sometimes, and saying, how come my dad got the good life? How come he gets to keep drinking? How come I got to do all this work in this book? How come I got to do service? How come I got to have a sponsor? How come? How come all I do is go to meetings and go to diners and more meetings and more diners and an occasional movie? Like, when do I get to live, for Christ's sake, you know? Now, today, I can't wait to, like, retire and go to meetings and diners. And, like, I want my life as a newcomer back, you know? I want it back. I love that life. You know, I didn't know about dry cleaning and paying your bills and all this other stuff, you know? Remember one time telling my old sponsor, Winston, I called him up one day at the payday and I was like, I did this. He's like, what do you want, a medal? He's like, Billy, people have been doing that for thousands of years. He's like, I know this is new to you, paying your bills, paying your rent on time. He's like, but really, people have been doing this for a long time. And, you know, unfortunately, again, I have to say that if you get with people who believe in the traditions and do the work out of the book, not only won't you like what they say, but then when you say what they've said to other people, you won't be popular. It's like a double-edged sword. I hate hearing what he says, because I said, how do I get out of debt? And he said, pay your bills. And I said, come on, pay my bills. There got to be like a better answer than that. He just said, no, pay your bills. But I found that the message out of the book and the belief in the tradition sometimes is not popular and doesn't make you the most popular person in meetings. But that popular people don't stay sober. This is not a popularity contest. You know, my life depends upon this. And I want to close with telling you a couple of things about the actual experience of living this. Is that, first of all, I told you I wanted to be like my dad. He got to keep drinking. 4 years ago, I knelt in front of my dad's coffin. I got down on my knees. There was two police officer honor guards in front of it, all his medals, the flag of his police department, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the United States. And what sat there was a 62-year-old man who looked 92, who was legally blind and missing his left leg because he was diabetic and chose to keep drinking, whose liver was descended. I mean, a shell of the man I grew up and loved. And I can assure you, as brokenhearted and filled with sadness as I was, that when I was sitting there praying, I was not asking God why my dad was the lucky one. In fact, as I got up from that kneeling pew and walked back, really I said, thanks, God. Thanks for giving me the solution that I'm not like that right now. And my mom, God rest her soul, I buried her a year before my dad. So those certain low spots ahead, see, when I was 32 years old, I did not plan on losing my two parents whatsoever. And I was driving down Lakeshore Drive one day, and my sister called and said, Billy, mom has stage 4 inoperable cancer, terminal. And my first thought was, this sucks. I've really only had her back in my life for 7 years. And I love her to death. And God, why are you screwing me again? See, because if I want to stand here today and tell you that if you do the work, you're going to love God every day, or every day is going to be great, I'm a liar. The certain low spots ahead mandate that I live and work the work in this book. Because then a man said to me, Billy, you need to make sure that you have no regrets. You need to do whatever it takes to spend the last year or so of your mother's life and not, after she dies, say, oh my God, I should have taken more time off from work, or I should have spent more time with her. And so that's what I did. And you know, I spent 8 months with my mom that I think most sons would die for. This Depression-era Irish Catholic woman who I hated so much one day, all my whole life. You know, I used to hate being 12 years old in a supermarket with her using coupons. It was on my resentment list forever, you know? She'd only shop on triple coupon day, and she had it alphabetized, and I was embarrassed. But you know what? When I went home to take care of her, and I went out to the supermarket, you can bet your ass that I took her coupons, and I made sure she saw on her receipt that I used the coupons. You know what? And I would come home, and I'd say, Mom, we can go anywhere out to eat tonight. And she'd be like, well, it's senior night and 10% off at Friendly's. And I'd be like, Mom, we can go anywhere. Nope. All right, Mom. Let's go to Friendly's, you know? Because that's what she loved, you know? And even at one point she said she liked me better than my siblings at the time, because she said she had never found that much of a use for her bad son, because I would have a pack of Kent 100s ready for her when she got out of chemotherapy, you know? My other siblings are too much of a goody-goody, you know? They would never do something like that, you know? But my mom knew that she could depend upon me to have the goods, you know? I mean, what am I going to do? The lady's dying of cancer and she wants a freaking Kent 100. I'm going to give her a Kent 100, you know? But let me tell you about the certain low spots ahead. And I'm closing with this, is that in December of 24th of 1999, I went home to my mother's house with my siblings, and I wrapped my mom's last Christmas gift. And my siblings, see, they can drink. And I was devastated, crying, knowing that it's the last gift I'm ever going to give her. And, you know, I remember opening up my laptop and seeing tons of messages from people in AA. So many phone calls, I couldn't even keep my cell phone voicemail clear, you know? And, you know, the next morning I got up, I got to tell you that I got sober at midnight in New York City, and there's a lot of gay men and women there, and I didn't like them and wouldn't eat out with them, and I used to go home and say, God, why am I surrounded by so many gay people? Am I gay? What's going on? I mean, my head is crazy. But, you know, my brother Terrence came out of the closet when I was 4 years sober. See, I knew that's why God had me around all those people. No, really, because, see, I grew to love them. They became to become my best friends. You know, my sponsor, Winston, was an African-American male. There were no African-Americans in my house growing up. That's just the truth, you know? When my brother said he was gay, the only thing I knew to do was to be his brother, you know, to be his friend. And, you know, that morning I got up and I went, that Christmas morning, I went to the hospice my mother was in, and we had her room decorated for Christmas, and we were going to have people over, and I had 2 Dunkin' Donuts large coffees, and I had her wig, her makeup, her Charlie perfume that she always wears, her eyeshadow, the whole bit, you know. And, you know, and I jumped up in her bed with her, and we cranked up the back, and we threw back 2 large cups of coffee, like I was drinking a beer with my best bud. And I put her makeup on, and her perfume on, and her wig on. And she told me about her final plans, things she wanted. And she told me, and this is for where she comes from, to never believe that alcoholism really exists. She said, "Billy, don't ever leave AA. Getting my son back is the greatest gift God ever gave me." You know, and about 3 weeks later, I stood at a podium like this in a church on Long Island, and I had to tell a couple of hundred people how difficult it was for such a far from perfect son to say goodbye to a very so close to perfect mom. You know, and I buried my mom with dignity and grace the same way I buried my dad. And I tell you that if I was not sober, or if I was not in AA, not around it, I would have never had the privilege to do that. And I've become the moderate brother. I'm like the vacation planner. That's ridiculous. I hate that. It makes me feel like I'm the uncool person, you know? It does. And, you know, I just want to say, as I shut up here, that everybody in AA has a gift. Speaking is no big deal. It's nice. Maybe some people do it better than others. I don't know. But I know this. I know some people who work miracles on tables and Denny's across from another person. I know some people who can take the 15 minutes in a car to and from a meeting and work miracles that are not possible. Everybody has a gift, and I've been taught the only sin in AA is not to find out what your gift is and then take it and run with it. And run with it. And, you know, I've been in service, involved in service, you know, in young people's conventions. I've been a GSR, a DCM. In 1999, I was 32 years old. I was the youngest delegate to the General Service Conference. That was, you know, to be there, what AA calls in passing on, the permanent successors to the founders. And last week, you know, I was in a jail in Riverhead. That's 54 miles from New York City. That's 13 years ago. Last week, I was selected to be a member of the Trustees Corrections Committee at GSO. I mean, that's just amazing. How do you go from sitting in a jail cell to then being able to give back to the fellowship that saved your life? So if you're new and you hate AA, you and me have a lot in common. If you hate people that speak, all that other stuff, keep coming. Find people that are active. I'm not afraid to admit, yes, my first 4 step was amazing, but getting cable back and ESPN was amazing, you know? I'm not afraid to admit that going to my first AA convention was great, but going to Metallica, Guns N' Roses was better, you know? I'm not afraid to admit that going to Yankee Stadium sober, knowing that my life's not over, that I can still go to baseball games, that stuff is why I'm here. You know, I've been given a way to live that a lunatic who suffers from the disease I suffer from can actually function in society, except it comes with some work. And, you know, it's been a privilege to be here, and I want to thank Chris and this organization for having me. Thank you very much.